Beach time on southern Portugal's Algarve coast can make for a memorable family vacation.
At 9 o'clock in the evening, when it is still light and they are digging holes in the sand and just having the time, their time to be children.
Follow your ears when deciding where to eat dinner in the south of Spain.
If you see a place that is busy, is noisy, filled with Spaniards shouting to each other like World War III is going to start any minute, that is the place you have to go.
And Granada is one of those fan cities.
Coming up, we look at popular vacation options in Portugal and Spain. And Kevin Kelly's back with more of his massive project photographing changes across Asia in the last 50 years.
I spend my life hunting for these little pockets that have retained the costume, the architecture, the food.
Let's explore together for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. How does a sunny beach vacation in the south of Spain and Portugal sound right about now? Coming up, a pair of Spanish tour guides steer us around the crowded Costa del Sol. We'll see what the region of touristy Mediterranean beach resorts can offer besides tropical weather, and where you'll find authentic Spanish culture and attractions. Later in the hour, Kevin Kelly helps us look at how connecting with traditions across Asia can provide a guidepost for where we're going in our modern world. Let's start today's Travel with Rick Steves along Portugal's south coast. From Land's End to the Spanish border, there's 100 miles of warm beaches and charming resort towns known as the Algarve. Our guides are Cristina Duarte from Lisbon and American-born Robert Wright, who used to live in Lisbon but now has relocated to a hillside village just over the border near Seville. Cristina, Robert, bom dia.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Obrigada.
So when we think of the Algarve, Cristina, what does it mean to a Portuguese?
Holidays. It's where we go to holidays with our families.
Nice.
And normally, because it is the kids are in school until the end of June, so everybody goes at the same time. So July and August can be pretty crowded. But if we have a chance and going out of July or August, it is a marvelous place to go. Wonderful beaches, wonderful food, very good offer of places where to stay, hotels, and also houses that we can rent, houses or apartments. And June is absolutely beautiful. Until the first week of July, it's quiet.
So that is interesting that there's a huge bell-shaped curve of demand. And in the summertime vacation,
yes,
it's everybody's down there.
Yes.
Now, Robert, when you think of the popularity among locals, and you were a local, are the locals looking for a big resort, or are they looking for the cute little cove or the little town that hides away?
I think locals are looking for just basically good, nice, relaxing beaches wherever they may be.
Right.
Because what Cristina was saying is it's kind of like when you go off-season, a little bit off-season, you have to think that you can't go to Nazaré. You can't go to the beaches that are up north because the weather's still not quite
good. Oh, that's a good point. Because there are good beach resorts,
sure,
north of Lisbon.
Sure.
But if you're a little bit shoulder season, mm-hmm, you want to go in the south.
You want to go south because you're guaranteed good weather.
Down there by Morocco.
Yeah.
Now, when you go to the south, I'm sure that every region of Portugal has some different cuisine. What do you think about to enjoy the food scene when you're on the Algarve?
The food scene is fantastic because you're right there on the water. You get every kind of fresh seafood you can imagine.
Oh.
And I guess the best expression of that in Portugal is the dish that everybody goes there for. It's the cataplana.
Yes.
The cataplana is like just a big, big mix of all this great seafood, some potatoes, juicy broth. It's just really like the essence of the Algarve.
If I have a joy meter, it just went off the chart with both of you here when you said the word cataplana.
Yeah.
Cataplana. Cristina, what do you think of? What's in a cataplana?
Cataplana is all kind of fish. It's basically, the cataplana is the name, not of the recipe, but is the name of the pot.
And it's a fun thing to buy as a souvenir. Yeah.
Yes,
I noticed
yes,
a lot
yes,
of
yes.
people like to
it's
buy the cataplana.
It's a copper clam-shaped pot,
mm-hmm,
so it's like a double pot,
yep,
with the pot and the cover, and we slice onions, potatoes, and the fish in raw,
mm-hmm,
and we just leave it to steam in very low cooking.
Okay.
So all the flavors of the fish,
mm,
the different ones, are there. So more variety of fish you have, more it becomes good, of course.
Now, when I'm researching the chapter in our Portugal guidebook for Salema, which,
mm-hmm,
is my favorite town on the Algarve, every restaurant is so proud of their Cataplana.
Oh, yes. Mm, yes.
And each one must be a little bit different. Robert, how could a Cataplana be different from one restaurant to the next?
First of all, depending on the catch of the day, whatever is available, that's one thing. Another would be maybe the type of vegetables you add to it. You could add red peppers. You could not add red peppers. Yeah. You could add different spices if you wanted
to. So there's a variety of spices.
There's a variety of things you can do to it, yeah.
So it's sort of
sometimes
a
little bit
of
cream.
For them.
Sure.
A little bit cream.
You could add cream.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. These are like nice little old-style pressure cookers.
And you can also, because it's a lot of fish, you can split it. Can you order?
Yeah, you have to. You have to. These are big. Yeah,
these are big.
Yeah,
yes.
You wouldn't go to Spain and order paella for one.
Okay.
So you
I certainly
wouldn't go to Portugal and order Cataplana for one.
That's a good way to put it. Now, when we think of the Algarve, there's basically two halves, geographically and personality-wise. How would you characterize the East and the West, Robert?
I would say the East is a little bit more laid back, less touristy, a little bit...
Seems less dramatic to me.
It is less dramatic. There's less hubbub and like not really a lot of stuff going
on.
Because
in the West, you've got these postcard-perfect rock formations that people just love.
Yes.
What are we talking about?
Talking about rock formations by the sea, and we can actually visit them because they are in many small-town fishing towns.
Mm-hmm.
You can either organize your tour on the caves by a local company.
So the big city, Lagos.
Yes.
And they have little $15 boat rides out to the rocks.
Yes, and it's about 1 hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very nice because you can get actually inside of these caves and you have this emerald, beautiful sea colors and also the formation of the caves of the rocks are absolutely beautiful.
Mm.
But if a person is in a smaller place like Salima, you might find, you know, a fisherman that has a little boat.
Has a boat. We'll
yes, a little boat and takes you out for a while, for a half an hour.
Now, that's a fun way for a fisherman to make a little extra money.
Yes,
and it's
exactly.
a fun way for a tourist to have an unforgettable experience.
That's with a local.
Yeah,
with a local. Very nice. Our guides to the scenic Algarve coast of Portugal are Cristina Duarte and Robert Wright. We have links to their websites in the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Our phone number is 877-333-RICK. Gary's calling from Rochester in New York. Gary, have you been to Portugal?
I have. And to your guest, bon dia.
Bon dia.
All right. So what was your experience in the Algarve, Gary?
I had come back from Morocco, and I was a graduate student. I was traveling around, and I was in Huelva in the south. West corner of Spain, and some friends I had known said, if you get that close, you got to go over to the Algarve. And my ultimate destination was Lisboa, but the train takes you right along the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped in Faro, and you're right, Faro is not a tourist town that I recall, but it's a beautiful small town, and you can get around in it, and there's some wonderful people there.
Mm-hmm. Did you find an expat community down there? Because I know a lot of Brits like to head down to the south coast of Portugal. I've got a friend who retired down there.
Yep. Actually, I asked some people in town where's a good place to stay, and they said there's a small hotel on the village square, and they had Portuguese flags and British flags out in front. So I said, so I'm going to try that. And I went in, and it was a couple from England. They had been there, opened the place for a few years before, and they had a nice little British happy hour, kind of a British pub. They sent me to a restaurant called Fin del Mundo, the end of the earth.
Huh.
I ended up going to this restaurant for 3 nights in a row while I was staying in Faro. And I'll tell your guests, this is a while ago, so it's not this cheap, but I think it was $3 or $4. I got a half a liter of wine and a plate of the biggest pieces of fish I had ever seen, to potatoes and bread. And I just sat there and ate and drank my heart out.
You know, when you find a fun little local restaurant like that and just nice house wine and some fresh seafood, you almost feel like, is this right when you get the bill? It's very affordable.
Oh,
and it is fun.
It was beautiful. I mean, you know, you get on the train and it takes you over through Albufeira and that coastal area and those beaches and the locals, they pull the boats up on the sand, and it's fantastic. Anybody who's not been there should make it a priority. It's really not expensive, but it's one of the most beautiful spots I've been to.
So, and you were just heading from southern Spain to Lisbon, and you sort of hopped off the train, and you discovered the Algarve. Gary, thanks so much for your call.
You're welcome. Thanks, Rick.
Take care. That's a very good point, is that the train transportation is good, and there's this wonderful sort of mix of expats and Portuguese Robert, you're an expat there. It's kind of a nice, easygoing, you know, southern coast vibe.
There is. And actually, I can do a little bit of a comparison for you, if you like, Rick, because I know the Costa del Sol in Spain pretty well by living there.
Uh-huh.
And then also kind of comparing it to what the Algarve has. There's really, you know, if the Costa del Sol is so developed and overrun,
right,
with just the same kind of tourists, but it's just more developed. And so you go to the Algarve and you get a much more relaxing experience. There are expats there.
Yeah.
There's people, there's Dutch, there's British, there's people from everywhere. But it's on a much smaller scale, and there's not nearly as many high rises.
You know, because it's on a much smaller scale, I think there's an attitude that they're going to mix in a little better, because there's so many Belgians in this Belgian favorite town on the Costa del Sol,
sure,
and so many Dutch and so many Germans and so many Brits that they become British enclaves or German enclaves that are looking not for a change in culture, but for a change in weather and a nice beach.
Sure.
That's the Spanish Costa del Sol.
That is.
You don't find that really on
not
the
as much
Portuguese.
And remembered Portugal.
And a lot of the little hotels happen to be run by British expats, which means there's no communication problems.
That's true,
and
yeah. So like, we get a good hotel experience or a good homestay experience.
For sure.
And there's no problem with communication either.
And that helps a lot. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Robert Wright and Cristina Duarte. We're talking about the south coast of Portugal, the Algarve. And let's just close with your favorite Algarve moment. Robert, if you would just wanted to capture one iconic experience or one unforgettable memory on the Algarve, what would it be?
I think for me it was the very first time I went out to Cape Sagres.
Hmm.
So growing up in the United States and then moving to Europe and like hearing all these stories of exploration and Henry the Navigator and everybody who went out, and to actually physically see the sunset right there on the Cape.
Looking out at the sea where they didn't
Atlantic,
know there was dragons out there.
Didn't know what was there, and just looking out west and knowing that, wow, there's a lot of space between here and where I'm from.
Yeah. Standing on what feels like the tip of the Earth.
It really does feel like the end of the Earth. Yeah.
Oh, my. Cristina.
For me, it's like, as family vacation.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful place to take the children and as a family. Just looking to the kids and seeing how much fun they are having at 9 o'clock in the evening when it is still light and they are digging holes in the sand and just having the time, their time to be children and just discovering on the rocks the little shells and the clams and the stars. All that makes part of it.
They're putting together the little pieces that when they're your age, they'll look back and think,
exactly,
my mother and father gave
exactly
me a beautiful childhood.
Yes, that's what we like to take our children for, is like also building the mosaic of their memories.
And as young at heart travelers, as kids at heart with a passport,
yes,
we can all enjoy that.
Yes.
We can put together those memories
definitely
we'll cherish for the rest of our lives. Cristina Duarte, Robert Wright, obrigado.
De nada.
Obrigado.
Bon dia.
Bon dia.
Bon dia.
Head east from the Algarve, follow the coastline into Spain and around Gibraltar, and you'll find yourself in the region known as the Costa del Sol. Up next, a pair of Spanish guides help us navigate the popular Mediterranean resort region of southern Spain. And later, Kevin Kelly offers an appreciation for traditions that hold on across Asia, from the grassy plains of Kazakhstan to the shrines of Japan. He documents them in a colossal photo project. It's Travel with Rick Steves. It takes some convincing to get me to recommend any more than a few stops along Spain's south coast. The town of Nerja boasts the balcony of Europe as a gathering place overlooking its Mediterranean cliffs. Tarifa is a quaint springboard for sailing to Morocco. And Gibraltar, with its famous rock, keeps Britain's eyes on the entrance to the Mediterranean. But Spanish tour guides Jorge Roman and Francisco Gloria want us to know that there's more to appreciate and enjoy along the Costa del Sol than what I have nicknamed the crowded Costa del Turismo. Jorge is a native son of Malaga, the main city and airport hub of the southeast coast. And while Francisco Gloria lives in Pamplona in the north, his pride for Spain includes all corners of his country. They join us now on Travel with Rick Steves for a closer look at the coastal region of Andalusia. Jorge, Francisco, welcome.
Well, thank you for hosting us.
Thank you, Rick.
Jorge, you grew up in Malaga, deep in the south of Spain. Now, we think of the south of Spain, and we think of Andalusia, and then we've got the Costa del Sol. I really don't give the Costa del Sol much attention because I think it's a lot of expats. It's just a lot of people from the rainy north of Europe looking for a change of climate but not a change of culture. What's your assessment of the Costa del Sol, Jorge? And what's the difference between the south of Spain, Costa del Sol, and Andalusia?
Okay, south of Spain is Andalusia and Costa del Sol, both together. Now, Costa del Sol is just a coast from the Strait of Gibraltar to the southern eastmost point of the Iberian Peninsula. That is the Costa del Sol. And if it is taken by the British tourists as they live there as a second residence, also Germans, Dutch people, Irish people, there is a lot over there, and it's just beach resorts.
You know, when I'm down there, I hear local people complaining that there's no Spanish on the menus. It's just English or German or whatever is the dominant expat community. And what I enjoy when I'm driving across the Costa del Sol is tuning into, I think it's called Suncoast Radio. They've actually got a popular radio station for the English-speaking expats down there.
That's right. There are several local little ones, but there are several.
Yeah.
But the capital of Costa del Sol is Malaga, which is a beautiful destination nowadays. You have no idea in the last 25 years how much it has changed, the city of Malaga. Now, the city per se had nothing to do with all the tourists that used to go to the resorts and the beach and spend 15 days with a full board at the hotel with the beach in front and then back and nothing else. Now Malaga is in the top five destination, cultural destination in Spain. That is thanks a lot because of the Picasso Museum when they opened a few years ago over there.
Huh. Now, you know, that's very interesting because I visited Malaga, the big city of the Costa del Sol, mm-hmm. where the airport is and where so many people have timeshare condos and so on. I visited it many years ago, and I felt it was just a place where packaged European tourists would go, and it didn't have a lot to offer. But then I was just in the south of Spain, and everybody was raving about how Malaga is the exciting new destination. It has a great mayor. The city is well-organized. It's doing wonderful investments in itself, and it has the new Picasso Museum. So you're saying Malaga is now worth a more serious look than before?
The last wife of the Baron von Thyssen-Bornemisza Museum in Madrid, she had her own painting collection. She opened her museum in Malaga. The Hermitage opened a branch now in Malaga in the old tobacco factory, which is their national monument. George Pompidou Foundation has a branch in Malaga and one of the best abstract art museums, contemporary art museums in the whole world circuit of that kind of art is in Malaga as well.
That's really quite astounding.
Oh,
Malaga, which you don't think of as a great art center. So we got to give Malaga another look. Hey, Francisco, Jorge's from Malaga, so he's talking very nice about it. You're from the opposite end of Spain, way up in the north. What do Spaniards think of when they talk about people from Costa del Sol or Andalusia? Is there a generalization they'll make about people of the Deep South?
Well, if you go to stereotypes and the bad stereotypes, oh, people from Andalusia, they're always party, fiesta, and they don't work. That's the stereotype. Obviously, that's the joke. But what we think it's Andalusia, it's where the passion of Spain is, where the culture, the deep culture of Spain, the flamenco music, the singing, that is the gypsy culture. So here, the gypsy community, really, it's the basis of our culture, our heritage.
So in the United States, people shudder when you hear the word gypsies because that is now considered derogatory, and we're supposed to say Roma. What's the story in Spain with the word gypsy?
Well, for us, they are gypsies. What happened is that they came from India, okay? They migrated from India. And when they reached Europe, some went to the north through Romania, Romanis, Romans. And the other ones went through Egypt, through Africa. Egypt, Egyptians, gypsies.
Okay, so what do the local gypsies like to have themselves called in Spain?
Gitanos. Gypsies.
Gypsies.
So they are gypsies and they're proud to be gypsies. People say bad things about gypsies. For us in Spain, it's like, at least to me, it drives me nuts because they brought the knowledge of all of these incredible cultures into Spain. It was like a moving melting pot that arrived and we were lucky enough to have them here.
You know, I was in Granada, which is a leading city with gypsy community. They're famous for the flamenco and for Sacromonte there, the hill that is inhabited by gypsies historically. And I met a leader of that community. With my local guide, I was able to interview him, and I asked him, what do you like to be called? And he said, we're gypsies. We're proud of our gypsy heritage, and we call ourselves gypsies. So it's a tricky thing because I don't want to call gypsies Roma against their will in the context of Spain, but a lot of Americans will think that you're being derogatory. So we have to make that very clear. Our guides to the south coast of Spain right now on Travel with Rick Steves are Jorge Roman and Francisco Glaria. In their podcast called Spanish Loops, they talk about the cities and sights of Spain, its traditions and people. You'll find it on Spotify and Facebook, and from a link with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Hey, Jorge, we're talking right now about the many dimensions of the culture of southern Spain, gypsy culture and more. And Andalusia is the province in the south, mostly up in the hills. It's got three great cities, Cordoba, Sevilla, and Granada. It's got the hill towns. And then we've got the Costa del Sol. But along the coast, we have Tormolinas is very famous as a tourist trap.
So it is,
My favorite town is Nerja, N-E-R-J-A.
Yeah.
What do you recommend on the south coast there with all the resorts mixing up with other cities that are not so romantic?
Well, capital city is Malaga, which is one of the cities that you forgot to mention in Andalusia.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, I'm just trained not to look at Malaga, so that's going to change.
Well, Nerja is a good example that you mentioned, just to see some interesting old caves, what nature can do inside of a mountain. And there's always long lines every day to visit, so it's very demanded, especially among locals. And then another little town could be also Almuñécar, that belongs to the Granada county. The city of Granada is inland, but the county touches the Mediterranean. And for your information, Rick, as well, that part of Costa del Sol, going back like about 10 miles inland, is the only subtropical part in Europe. Hmm. And the production of tropical fruits like mango, avocados, and all kind of fruit. And they are really proud of it. And it's a big, big production right now.
But the interesting historical thing was a long, long time ago, pirates terrorized the coast and scared the local people inland. And I've learned that for almost every town on the coast, there's a sister town up in the mountains, which was where they went for refuge. Nerja has a town inland from it, for example, that's quite historic.
Frigiliana, yeah, it's called Frigiliana nearby, yeah. And it's like up in the hill, you can see the coast from the hill, but from the coast you can hardly find that town. You see many little white dots in the mountains, and those are tiny little towns that they are up there. Right now everybody rents a car when you go there, and you just try to find and discover spots that maybe some people have discovered before, and it's not so spoiled as the mainstream of that tourism that you're talking about.
Right.
You know, I call them flip-flop tourists.
Flip-flop tourists, yeah. Well, that's why most people, if you did a tally, just a statistical analysis of why are people on the Costa del Sol, they're not there to learn about the history. They're there to enjoy the beach, which is great. They're beach resorts, and that's basically what it is.
But Rick, you can combine both. You can go to the beach if you want to, just take a couple of days, and then go and immerse yourself in a day trip in the local culture.
And that's a very good approach to the Costa del Sol. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Jorge Roman and Francisco Glaria. Francisco's website is travelingsteps.es. And Jorge's website is travelingwithjorge.wordpress.com. And Jorge is spelled J-O-R-G-E. Hey, Francisco, you know, I've been going to Spain for 40 years, and bullfighting has always been a part of a visit, whether you choose to go to a bullfight or not. Who's attending bullfights these days?
Well, less and less people. We're beginning to see a very small young generation starting to go again to bullfighting. It's a very, very controversial topic around the world, obviously, but also in Spain. Right now, I would say we have 50% of population hates bullfighting, 10 15% can care less. It's like, oh, well, whatever. And the rest, so about a 35, 40% of the population, are pro-bullfighting.
Huh. Are matadors still celebrities?
Oh, yes. The good ones are top rock stars. I mean, they are like Taylor Swift.
Yeah, but they're all men. Are they considered sexy?
The thing is that they're all young, buffed, and they all have internet, Facebook, Instagram, and they all post, strangely enough, shirtless.
Shirtless?
Oh, yeah. They're very good looking.
Jorge, what's your take on that? Because I've had women guides in Andalusia that just swoon over the matadors. I go into the bullfight museum, and yeah, they just gaze at the statues of the matadors as if they're looking at their dreams come true. Yeah. So there is this mystique about the matador in their suit of lights.
Yeah. I believe that there is like an internal fight. Let's leave gender apart, okay? Whether it's a man or a woman, just admiring a person that is confronting such a beautiful animal as the bull is just by itself. But at the same time, to be honest, with all the years I've been guiding now, I still haven't found a correct answer. But that doesn't happen to the foreigner that doesn't know anything about it. It happens locally here as well.
Right. I think whether you like bullfighting or not, it's fascinating to go to the bullfighting museums at the historic arenas. And of course, I think the best one, well, there's one in Ronda and there's one in Sevilla. Correct. You don't need to go to both of them, but would you say those are the best two bullfighting museums?
Actually, there's one in Madrid as well, Madrid, and also in Pamplona as well. Look, if you want to try a bullfight one day, like a food that you never tried and you need to see or to taste if you like it or not, try one day a bullfight. Not everything is blood and killing an animal, which I don't like a killing. It's a sacrifice. And just around these big arenas, the ambience, the bars that they are around, and you can see the big heads of famous bulls. Yeah. And then you have everything related even with suits of famous matadors. And that is incredible. You don't even need to go to a museum. But yeah, if you want to go to a museum, go to the Sevilla or Ronda. That's a very good example.
Oh, yeah. Jorge, is it true that the news reports of the bullfights is in the, not in the sports pages, but in the culture pages of the paper?
True. True, but not only the bullfighting, it's also about the places or the lands or the people who owns that bunch of bulls. Are they going to be fought in whatever season? And
you know, it's an ethical decision people have to make. My feeling is it's an actual part of Spanish culture. If it was kept alive only by tourists, then I would say it's wrong for me to promote it. But if it's still kept alive by local people, I think it's ethnocentric to boycott it. You can boycott it if you want to, but it's a real thing. And like you said, you can go there and check it out without feeling that you are perpetuating something that's a needless brutality. It's part of the culture. It has a reason. I was just in Granada, you guys, and the waiters were not very polite or friendly in Granada in a couple of places. And somebody told me, Spaniards joke about the Grenadine waiters, and they say they don't have blood in their veins, but they have sour milk. You're laughing about that, Jorge. What does that mean? It kind of confused me. They said the people from Granada had sour milk instead of blood in their veins.
Well, you have to get into the culture. You have to, one of the things I just tell my people is go inside. If you see a place that is busy, it's noisy, filled with Spaniards shouting to each other like World War III is going to start any minute, that is the place you have to go. Just find an inch at the counter and get your claw out and put your claw there.
That's it. Both of you guys have said you got to fight for your place at the bar.
Yeah. Well, it's not a fight per se. I mean, you don't push the others. I mean, that way you won't get anywhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, just get your space. And then magically you see how that inch goes into 2, 3, 4 inches. You have space enough to place your hand there. And then just keep the eyesight of the waiter. All right. The moment you get the eyesight of the waiter, having your lips ready, what you want with the please at the end, por favor at the end, and they will give you right away that thing. But that's the way it is. If you don't get that because of the language barrier, it's like what we call, especially in the South, like sour milk in their veins instead of blood, you know?
Okay.
Yeah.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Jorge Roman and Francisco Glaria, and we are learning about southern Spain. Francisco, another interesting thing when I'm in the South is stag parties, and they call them farewell to singlehood. When you go to Granada, the city can be overrun by people having a farewell to singlehood party. Tell us about that in Spain.
It's like a bachelor party or bachelorette party, and Granada is one of those places that everybody goes. I mean, here, I live in, all the way in the north of Spain, so what you do is you get together with 4, 5, 10 friends, and obviously you go to a fan city, and Granada is one of those fan cities. So they take you to Granada, and you stay there like 2-3 days, and it's just a way to say goodbye. You know, you're gonna be married live. It's like, okay, it's just a way to say goodbye, but it's a big celebration. It's a fun thing, and Granada especially is super fun. So everybody goes to Granada.
Okay, everybody goes to Granada. That's the fun city if you want a farewell to singlehood party, or if you just want to have a great time on your vacation, even though a few of the waiters might have sour milk in their blood veins. You can have a good time in Granada. Hey, Francisco Glaria and Jorge Roman, thank you so much for joining us. And we just really appreciate you sharing your insights into your beautiful country, especially the south of Spain.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
You'll find more of our conversations about Spain with Francisco and Jorge in our show's archives at ricksteves.com/radio. His futuristic view of what the internet would become and how it promised to change the world informed his work at the Whole Earth Catalog and as senior maverick at Wired Magazine. But before all that, Kevin Kelly started an enormous photography project as he wandered the villages and backcountry of Asia. Up next, Kevin's back with more on how his 50-year-old Vanishing Asia project documents changes to age-old traditions from Turkey to the Himalayas and Pacific. And we'll also make time to squeeze in a little fresh appreciation for the art of Michelangelo with my original travel buddy, Gene Openshaw. So much seems to be vanishing right before our very eyes and our cameras. Kevin Kelly sorted through thousands of photos he had from some 50 years of wandering the varied landscapes and cultures of Asia. During the pandemic, he found time to compile 9,000 of them into a massive photo book collection in 3 hefty volumes. He calls it Vanishing Asia. As Kevin reminds us, there's no doubt Asia is the future. But its ancient cultures have much to teach us today. In Vanishing Asia, Kevin hopes that documenting the traditions and the otherness that may be slipping away can help inspire innovators, designers, and anyone who needs to think different as we speed our way into the future. Kevin Kelly, welcome back to Travel with Rick Steves.
Pleasure being here. You've been an inspiration, Rick, and so I'm so glad to share my project with you.
Yeah, well, you've done... The problem with my work is I've just named my company Europe, so I always have to go back to Europe. And, you know, I love Asia. I wrote a book called Asia Through the Back Door
I was very disappointed that you didn't keep updated.
Yeah, it was fun. And I love traveling in Asia for the same reason you do, the otherness, right?
Right.
The otherness. And you celebrate that. And that's what you see vanishing, is essentially the otherness in communities all around the planet, and particularly because there's so much beautiful, colorful, ritualistic, extravagant otherness in Asia, from the far west to the far east.
Yes, this is Asia between Turkey and Japan, and Siberia in the north and Indonesia in the south. It's a vast area where most of the people in the world live. And by the way, they are progressing into the future almost at a speed faster than we are. Yet they have this thousands of years old history that is being kind of steamrolled. So I'm interested in kind of helping people to see and believe that we can be more diverse than we have been.
And Kevin, isn't it interesting to you how those of us in the West, I would be a very good example of that, think the West is the norm? And I find myself saying, you know, in Western civilization, as if almost as a tip of the hat to there might be more, but of course it's the Western, it's Western that matters. But if you're in that other parallel zone, you kind of go, hello, most of the people are here. We've been here doing stuff longer than you have. You can take your printing press, your windmills, your gunpowder, and you can just kind of think you invented it.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time in the stands, Central Asia, and for us, it's like the most remote place on the planet would be, you know, Kazakhstan somewhere, right? Well, you go there and they're like, wait, no. We are the center of the world. You are way out on the edge. This is Central Asia. We have been here forever.
Asia.
Central.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody has come through. This is the center of the world.
I love looking at maps that are ethnocentric and thinking how silly it is that we have north up and the west in the middle, you know. And every society, of course, puts its society in the center, and not all of them have north up. Hey, when I was paging through your book, Kevin, your trilogy, I was struck by beautiful cities, fortresses, walls, and how so much architecture and cityscapes, it grows out of the terrain as if organic, you know, a mud fortress, because maybe there wasn't a lot of rocks or trees.
Absolutely. Until the age of artificial power, steam engines and oil and everything, things had to be used by muscle power. You needed muscle power to build everything. So all these castles and things were made with muscle by hand. Mm-hmm. And that limited where you could get materials from, because it took a lot of energy to move materials and rocks and stuff. So you would use what was local nearby. And it's amazing to me what beautiful stuff you can make from dirt, from mud. Beautiful castles, beautiful forts, beautiful homes. Think of adobe and that kind of rounded sculptural stuff.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And so most people in most of time and most humans in the past made their own home by themselves with their own hands.
It's like people in Iceland would stack turf to make a turf house. You know, people would use ice in the Arctic, and they would use mud in arid lands.
Right. They could make bricks from mud very easily. And I remember I was in a little house in southern China one time, and inside the house there was like a pile of bricks. And I was like, what are those for? Well, my son is making bricks. He's stockpiling the bricks so that he'll have enough to build his house.
Yeah.
So they would, year by year, add bricks to it, make them up. And then when there was enough, his son would build his home out of bricks.
And over time, it's like a sand castle on the beach, and it just sort of melts, or like a sugar that's melting into the little teacup. I remember when I was in Iran, in the countryside there, it's these melted sand castles, basically.
Right. Yeah. And as things age, they acquire a patina that actually we now pay a lot for in the West. This patina, this worn thing, the kind of the little sponged stucco walls, they acquire a history. You can see the history, and that makes them more beautiful. Mm-hmm. And that's what you get with these handmade things.
Kevin Kelly's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves. He's telling us how his huge collection of photographs from his many trips across Asia act as a trip back to a time that has largely passed from today's world. He captures traditions and designs before they disappear from 35 countries across the Asian continent in his huge 3-volume coffee table photo book collection called Vanishing Asia. You'll also find more on what futurism has looked like over the years on Kevin's early adopter website, which is simply kk.org. One theme I did enjoy in your book Vanishing Asia is the beautiful religious edifices. And a lot of them are fortified on hilltops. A lot of them have minarets or stupas or spires. Give me some thoughts on religious buildings across Asia.
Yeah, religions were often the center of a lot of my focus, because religion is one place where people will expend a lot of energy for beauty, which they might not even spend on their own homes. That was a very common thing, where they would contribute to a church or a monastery mm-hmm. or a temple. And that would become really the focus in beauty. And so they would have a level of intensity and quality of craftsmanship that even the homes didn't have. And this one things that people liked to have up into the sky was like a marker, something they could see and be reminded
right.
of. Because they built that.
So this is a parallel. You have the parallel with different societies. And, of course, in Europe, the pilgrims would be walking for weeks, and then they'd finally see the spires of that church breaking the horizon, still a day's hike away, you know?
Yeah.
And they would their spirits would be heartened. And you see the same thing in all the different religions. Your theme is vanishing Asia, and religion permeates Asian societies in ways that I think are even more than in Western society. Do you think as traditional Asia vanishes, as people leave that for the convenience and comfort and modernity of big cities, is the same thing happening with traditional religions in Asia?
Yes, we're seeing the same drop-off of belief, particularly in the organized traditional religions. What we do see also is the rise of many new religions. There are kind of more new religions starting in Asia than anywhere else.
So traditional forms of worship are changing,
right,
but there's still worship.
There's still worship of some sort, but there is a shift in the allegiance to the kind of organized traditional forms.
So that's a huge overlay of the color and fabric and wonder
right.
of Asia, is that when these places of worship no longer have incense and flowers and people, they become tourist attractions, and
yes.
we lose that. And some of my most memorable moments in the Pacific Rim have been in temples and places of worship that are so vibrant, so alive.
Yes, and they're noisy. I mean, this is always a shock. You know, traditional places of worship were not silent, quiet. They're usually kids running around, babies crying. They're practical and useful. They were not seen as separate. They were seen as part of the community. And so mm-hmm. some people were loud.
Yeah, that's what I felt in mosques in all across Islam. Mosques are places where people go with the kids.
Right.
You know, Kevin, when I think of East Asia, I think of beautiful rice terraces. It's almost like I loved a topographical map because you can see all these lines of altitude, you know. And a vast rice field, if there is a hill involved, it's going to be like a topographical map, isn't it?
Rice terraces have got to be one of the most beautiful things in the world because they have this right combination of being organic, wild, living, and yet they're obviously designed. They're the kind of a beautiful synthesis of the wild and the designed, right? They're absolutely gorgeous. However, the sad thing is I don't think very many of these terraced valleys are going to last very long because the amount of manual labor needed to maintain them is so severe. They don't make any economic sense to grow rice on.
Right. It's the same way you've got in Italy now, which is a wealthy country. You don't have people tending the terraced vineyards. Yeah.
Right, right. And so they might be subsidized by governments just because of the attraction, because they're so beautiful. But there are areas already that I've seen in China and other places where the terraces have been abandoned, and they rapidly return to becoming a hillside.
And from a photographer's point of view, if we want to get back to put on our tourist hats, that's a heartbreak from the camera point of view because you don't have these beautiful images
right.
of people in fields picking tea in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Exactly. It's I hate to say, but those are jobs that are going to go to the robots. We're going to have robots
yeah.
picking tea because it's a very
manual. And who wants to photograph that and put it on your wall?
That's my next book.
Robots picking tea.
Right, the robots taking over. But we joke about it, but that's actually where it's going.
Kevin Kelly's with us on Travel with Rick Steves to further explore what he saw over nearly 50 years, armed with just a camera and a backpack stuffed with film. His encounters with people and scenes of everyday life all across Asia are documented in his oversized photo book collection called Vanishing Asia. You'll find samples of Kevin's art and links to his presentations on futurism, including his TED Talk on how artificial intelligence can bring on a second industrial revolution. It's on his website, kk.org. So as you have studied Asia and for 4 decades or more been traveling around and documenting it on film, where do the traditions today survive the best? Are there remote villages in
yes.
the Himalayas and Kashmir? I mean, I've been in,
right.
I just think Himalayas and Kashmir because that's where I've been. I found I was in another world entirely. But where are they surviving the best?
Now you've touched my compulsion because this is what I do. I spend my life hunting for these little pockets that have retained the costume, the architecture, the food. And there are these little places that you can go to where there are these surprising gifts of intact kind of culture. Here's one that really kind of blew me away and was really fun, was Oman.
Mm, really?
Oman is the accessible part of Arabia, although Saudi Arabia has just opened. I was actually one of the first people let in before the tourists were open. But Oman is accessible Arabia and has retained culture, a retained costume, retained architecture. And you can go to places up in the hills where there is still a lot of this intact culture. And they're very, very proud and want to share it. So that's an example. I think there are places in Myanmar.
What we used to call Burma.
Burma.
Yep.
But it's one of the least developed and yet still very accessible. And you can go up into the lake in Leh, and you have an incredible experience of being in the time machine.
One thing I love when I do find myself in an amazingly cut off from modern world place is you've got the crafts right out on display.
Yes.
And like I remember in Herat in Afghanistan.
Yes.
Every 10 yards, there would be a different shop. And I remember the same thing in Bangalore in India.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
In Java. Every artisan is there, and you don't need a guidebook. You just, here's a guy sharpening knives. Here's a guy fixing shoes. Here's people baking bread in a way you never realized. Here's a guy cleaning ears. Here's a tailor.
Right, right. And not only that, but those places are kind of like garages. They're open.
Yeah.
They're open, and they're inviting you in. And that was, to me, one of the beautiful things about Asia was it was completely open. You could see how everything was being made. And you've wanted to see how a motor was being made. It was being assembled right before your eyes, and they didn't mind if you walked up and asked questions about it.
And you want to see how a cow is being sold. The carcass is right there on
right
the pavement,
there.
And which part would you like? And then hack, there you go.
Right. Before YouTube, this was YouTube.
This was it. Kevin, your book is, there's a lot of philosophy or philosophical thinking in your book. It's such a vast and fascinating study. You wrote something about when we lose the diversity as the engines of prosperity make us all similar, we lose the contrast, and that turns everything smooth. And when everything is smooth, you wrote, the wheels slip without moving forward. That's pretty trippy. Can you explain what you were talking about there? Because it sounds like the essence of what you're trying to share in this project of yours.
Yeah, I think I'm not the only person who noticed that if you travel to some big cities around the world, that there's a general sameness about them. They look very similar. If you just take a random photograph of a person on a street in the city, you couldn't tell what city you were in. And there's a fear, a legitimate fear, that will hold us back being all the same, because we will have the same idea and we'll be thinking the same things. And the world moves forward by having different ideas, by thinking differently, and that we need things that are slightly different and other than what we already know. And that is the engine of us moving forward.
And learning from and somehow keeping what is vanishing in traditional cultures can help us move forward. And that's kind of, I think, the takeaway from, I would think that's the takeaway from your project, Vanishing Asia.
Yes, it's to remind us and to allow for people who don't have the privilege of traveling to Asia, this is one way you can go and see all that difference.
Kevin Kelly, thank you for sharing this. It's so great to talk with you again. I just tell you, it's a daunting book, but man, what an experience to page through it. Vanishing Asia, congratulations.
Well, thank you so much. I'm always inspired by having a conversation with you, Rick. Thank you.
Take care, Kevin. You can listen to Kevin Kelly's earlier visits with us from the Travel with Rick Steves archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We have just a moment left today to appreciate perhaps the greatest sculptor in the history of Western art, Michelangelo, and the surprising figures that he never quite finished. Or did he? We call them the Prisoners, and they reside just outside his famous statue of David at the Accademia in Florence. I'm talking about Europe's artistic masterpieces for a moment with Gene Openshaw, the co-author of many of our books and TV shows, as well as Gene's latest book, Michelangelo at Midlife. Hey, Gene,
Countless travelers have enjoyed Michelangelo's David, but so many of them overlook Michelangelo's other statues, the ones that are standing just a slingshot throw away right there in the Academia.
The prisoners, yeah. Those are those four statues. They're kind of chunky looking. The ones that line the nave leading up to David.
Now, they couldn't be more different than David in so many ways.
Where David is the symbol of perfection, the prisoners were left unfinished, still stuck in the marble that surrounds them.
And, I mean, think about it. Where David looks totally confident, the prisoners, well, they're twisting and turning. It seems like they're in agony.
Yeah, like Michelangelo himself was when he sculpted them. These statues were just one small part of a massive tomb that Michelangelo had envisioned. He began the project as a strapping young man.
Like David.
Yeah, but as the project dragged on and on with many delays and detours, and Michelangelo got older, he ended up feeling like
a prisoner. Like a prisoner,
yeah.
The prisoners almost look like they're trying to free themselves from those stone blocks.
Exactly. Michelangelo famously said that his job was not to create a statue, but just to liberate the figure that God had put into the marble. These prisoners show the agony of that process
and the ecstasy of the result. Gene, I just love talking about art with you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Murrah-Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Quirt. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll look for you again next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
I've found that if you equip yourself with good information and expect yourself to travel smart, you can. And that's why the Rick Steves guidebooks are consistently the best-selling series of guides to Europe. Pick up the latest edition at your favorite bookseller or at ricksteves.com.